tradition and pick it up.
This is Glenda Lang by interviewing Mr. Charles Hargens, illustrator, on June 19, 1984. Joining in the discussion is Mr. Randolph By, artist of Bucks County. Okay, Mr. Hargens, would you like to tell us something about your life, which is most interesting?
I think you probably refer to the ancient beginnings of way, way back. How it all came about down to the present time. So my early beginnings were in the Black Hills, South Dakota, where my father was a doctor and my mother was a school teacher. I was born there in Hot Springs, which was sort of a summer resort back in the early 1900s because of the fact that we had mineral waters which had medicinal qualities to it. So I had the usual normal childhood, I think, of going to school, working around, doing chores around the house. In addition to the fact that my father was a doctor, we were also in the ranching business, which I think in later years is the reason that I do the kind of work that I do, which is principally Indians, cowboys, covered wagons. Our ranch spread was quite large. We had about 30,000 acres of ground on the Cheyenne River.
This was a cattle ranch? Cattle ranch?
Yeah, we raised cattle and had a horse herd and a lot of wheat and corn. And the ranch was bordered by the Cheyenne River, which is one of the old points of interest now in that whole area, which had been at one time brought into prominence just because of General Custer having traversed it many times. And also, the Cheyenne River was a crossing point for stagecoaches between Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Denver, which led up into the Black Hills of Custer, town of Deadwood, famous for Bill Hickok, Wild Bill.
Wild Bill.
Which everybody knows in the movies, I think. Mm-hmm. Now it's been done and done and done so many times. So that was my beginning of growing up there. My mother painted. There was a fashion then, a trend to decorate pillows, satin pillows or whatever kind, with flowers and things. So I guess maybe that was either smelling or looking at the oil paint that maybe gave me some sort of feeling about I might want to do that, although I think the whole thing was predicated on the fact that my father being a doctor, I was to be a doctor. But early, I found out that I could make drawings of things that people recognized, just instinctively. So I know my mother had charcoal, a box of charcoal and paper, and I got to making drawings of people's barns and houses, and for which as I said, I found out that I could make drawings of things that people recognized, and these were things around the neighborhood, in the town, barns and houses, and for which I started out selling things very early.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 6 years old, and I used to get 25 cents a piece for making drawings.
When you were six?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't mean a thing to me then, except that it was fun to do, and around the neighborhood they'd say, "Did you see the drawing Charlie Hargens made?" I said, "No." And they said, "Well, I guess I bought one." So here I was working up a business of 25 cents. In my childhood, I thought, gee, this beats punching cows on the ranch. So that was really the beginning, I think. And as time went on,
but you were really living in the midst of real cowboy life on the ranch, even at that time.
Yeah. Well, we lived in town, and the ranch was 16 miles down the road from town.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time there. The ranch, as I said, was on the bank of the Cheyenne River. And the Cheyenne River was probably half a mile wide, maybe a foot deep.
Mm-hmm.
And full of quicksand. Very dangerous to get into it. But right at our ranch, underneath the river, there was a stone, I don't know what you'd call it, was stone underneath, and the Indians from the Pine Ridge Reservation used to come up going to Hot Springs, the town, and they'd cross right at our ranch. And they knew where that was underneath the water.
What were these Cheyenne Indians?
Sioux. They were all Sioux on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
So early I got, I guess you'd call it, acquainted with the Indians. There were always Indians in town. They had a special place for them to park just outside of town where they could set up their tents, teepees. They all had horse and wagon. Once in a while, someone way, way back would have some broken down automobile. But I knew a great many of them, and my father had his own hospital. And many patients were Indians from the reservation, because they had two doctors on the reservation, but neither of them were surgeons. So my father got all the surgery from part of the reservation. So it seemed like around the yard and the house, there were always Indians gathered,
mm-hmm.
waiting for someone.
Terrific subject matter.
So that was my, and then down at the ranch, coming to town where they would cross the Cheyenne, it seemed like they would always get there about noontime. And the ranch cook always kept a big dish pan full of donuts to pass out to them as they'd come in. So some of them, they were all pretty nice. And I got acquainted quite well with some of them. In later years, I would see them in town when I was living in the East and going back every summer. I kept a small studio there. And I had all my equipment, easels, and darkroom, and all photography and everything. So I just drive out from here to there, and didn't have to cart much stuff except paints and brushes and a few things mm-hmm. like that.
And did you have them sit for you occasionally?
Oh yeah. Or they were always up around asking for money. So I would give them $2 here and $2 there. So they would, and they sort of took an interest in closing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charles, how did you hear about the Pennsylvania Academy?
Well, I will tell you that a little bit. And I did a lot of photography. was much easier to photograph things than sit down and make a drawing. So I have I call it a fantastic collection of vehicles, every kind of a thing that was used in the West. And every kind of a horse that had 4 feet. And all the Indians and the wagons, all of them. So
I'd love to see that.
I acquired a nickname from the Indians, and translated it, meant Charlie Push. And the pushing was when I held up the camera and pushed on the shutter release. So I was Charlie Push. And my father had been adopted into the Sioux Nation because of what he did for the Indians. And he had a nickname which translated meant Big Smoke, because he was a rather fiery character, profane at times, and drove a buckboard and a team fast it would go over rocks. The automobiles came along and you had to get out of the way for Doc Hargens. So that was Big Smoke.
That was an appropriate name.
A lot of action.
Very appropriate.
Yeah. So it was quite a decision as to what I was going to do.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one brother who was 3 years younger than myself. And eventually he ran the ranch. That was his job, taking care of the ranch. Mm-hmm. But he was a real dyed-in-the-wool Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision of... I think the thing that really saved me was the fact that I had an allergy, hay fever. And down on the ranch with the wheat field, it was burning. So I think that was the reason that finally the family said, well, he doesn't want to be a doctor. Although I had offered to go to Chicago and start in studying medicine after high school. But then we had a very drastic family split up. That led, I think, to the fact that the influence of my father's second marriage to a person from New York who was interested in all the arts and things. And I think she was the one that said that, let's give Charlie a try. So I had, in my growing up years, I had gone to Council Bluffs, Iowa to go to high school, which is across the river from Omaha. And my interest then was to the point where I wanted someone to show me what to do with paints. So I took lessons from a portrait painter in Omaha. He was good.
This was while you were in high school?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I would go over Saturdays and work in his studio. But he was a pretty good painter. So my job was keeping the studio clean and washing his brushes and cleaning his palette, which I didn't like to do every time. And one summer, when I was working with him in the studio, there were three young fellows that came in and wanted to know if they could rent the studio in the Saturday afternoons and have a model to pose. Well, that was all I was. Mr. Rothery, it was Albert Rothery. And lo and behold, one of the three fellows had gone to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. And he was a shining light there. Walt, you might know him as a watercolorist. Heitland.
Oh, really? Bill Heitland? Yeah, I knew him.
Yeah. Well, he was the... And so I would, when they were Saturday afternoons posing with a model, I would work with him too. So Heitland had gone to the academy, and he won a scholarship to Europe. So when the decision was made that I could go east for a year in art school, my stepmother, so called, thought that I should go to New York, the Art Students League. But this thing in the background of Pennsylvania Academy in Europe, I think that was the influence. So I came.
Well, that is if you got a Crescent Scholarship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, you had to earn that.
Yeah.
They didn't give it to everybody.
No. So I came. So I came east and went to the academy for a year. And I went back to Dakota.
Who was teaching at the academy at the time?
Breckenridge, Garber, Pearson, Henry Carter had the illustration class. Then it was well organized because they would invite some well-known national figure to criticize them in class for 2 months. So they rotated the influence in whatever someone did. So we had, we had Philip Hale from Boston, who was very good in drawing.
Was there George Hardy later on?
No, yeah. He came, George Harding, after McCarter died, George Harding took McCarter's job. And there was Emil Carlson, who was a good painter. Edwin Blashfield, who was a world painter. And they rotated just every year in the life class. So you've got a sort of a cross-section of it. But, personally, I was never interested in painting portraits or painting landscapes or something. Although I was in the painting class rather than the illustrators class. So my whole background was painting. But very early, I was an avid reader. My mother, being a school teacher, she read constantly. I can remember, or maybe I was 3 or 4 years old, sitting on her lap and she reading a book to us. So that excited my imagination, I guess. Rather than paint portraits, I was always visualizing something that I was reading and putting it in
something
graphics.
Some action.
Yeah, something like that. So that was generally...
So this is what then decided you on illustration rather than
art. And I got along very well in the academy, and I worked, I knew no one in the city, so I was fortunate in finding a place to live on 21st Street, which was not too far from the academy, Milwaukee Street, and a very nice landlady. So I lived all of my life going to the academy. In the academy, the thing that interested me, which I think led a lot to do with what I do, was the composition class, which was run by Mr. Pearson. Have you ever knew Pearson?
I didn't have a person like him.
So I was always bringing in things, and everyone else was bringing in a composition of some kind. Mine was seen by always animals or figures or vehicles or something like that. And about the second year, there was a student in school who had finished the academy, going to Europe a couple of times. His name was Owen, Buck Owen. He was then starting selling things to advertising agencies. So he was from Kansas City and I was from Dakota. So he would kind of look after me.
Mm-hmm.
So he said one time, Charlie, why don't you take one of these drawings down to Saturday Post? Well, I that was, you know, way, that was so far in the future. So I finally did get up there and I went down with three or four charcoal drawings, which at that time were ships, water. Because the biggest thing I'd ever seen was the Missouri River. So when I got to Philadelphia, the waterfront fascinated.
So you were really impressed.
Jeez. So lo and behold, I sold two drawings of the Saturday Post when I was going to school.
Really? And not even your Western work?
No. Gee, so I was really, I thought, well, this is great. I think I got $35 or $45 a piece. And that was a heck of a lot of money way back then. Jeez. So
tell me, Charlie, your education came much after the Howard Pyle School in Wilmington, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
He was active around the turn of the century.
Yeah. But in Dakota, we subscribed a lot of magazines. We had a complete bound series of the Century, Harper's, Scribner's magazines, and I used to go through those. So I have a collection of around about 600 piles of reproductions.
Yeah.
And when I was even going to high school, the subject fascinated me, the action or whatever it was. And then I saw some reproductions of Frank Brangle, an Englishman. But he was the god of all painters. So, a little sideline on that was that either last year or year before when we were in London, and I have a big book of Brangle's. In there are all the sketches that he made for murals for Selfridges in London. So Lois and I went into Selfridges to see these murals. Talked to two or three people, finally got to the manager and he said, I never heard of
them. Oh.
And they're not in the building at all. So I think in the interval they had floored in this big rotunda where these things were, and so I don't know whatever happened to the Browns.
Good heavens.
So then we went to the Tate Gallery. I knew they had, and they said, we don't have any Browns. We have them all down in the cellar if you want to make an appointment. With us, we'll show them to you if you want to come special.
Did you go? No.
Maybe it was Madison.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, anyway. So at that time, I tried to do like Brangle did. A lot of color, done very directly, and so on. So that was... So then I was smitten with a very beautiful girl in the academy.
Of course.
Which eventually became Mrs. Hargens. She was one of Henry McCarter's prize students in the illustration class. So in later years, I had my studio in Philadelphia. She had her studio on Washington Square. With a person who had gone to the academy together. So her name was Marjorie, and she was very successful. She did work for Ladies Home Journal, Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and they were all style drawings. They were more than fashion drawings, they were fashion. So
stylized fashion drawings.
So
oh,
between the two of us, we did very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you started out with Post Magazine, and you sold them the two seascapes.
Well,
and then
were,
where did you go from there?
They were seascapes. They were tramp steamers or things at docks and a lot of smoke and pile of brandy and all.
Mm-hmm.
So then.
But that was your first connection with Post magazine. Because I can well remember your paintings when I was a child, and but I couldn't wait for Post magazine to come to see the Western paintings.
The thing is that when you're starting out as an illustrator, I think this is different than being a painter. Because a painter, you can send your thing to a show and they either take it or they don't. But with an illustrator, the minute you walk into a publisher, you're in competition with the people that have been there for years and years. You might be 20 and they might be 50. But the competition is there, so it's a very difficult thing to get a foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrific. So you did all kinds of things. For instance, I had a connection with a sign company. Every Thursday, I went to the sign company at 1 o'clock. And they supplied all the theaters in Philadelphia with posters, which were put out on easels and then in those days in front of the theaters. So I had 20 to do between 1 o'clock and 6. And these were pictures of dancers, acrobats, comedians, animals, the whole thing. So I had to produce 20 of them by 6 o'clock.
20 of them by 8.
And these were on one sheet. One sheet is 28 by 40 inches. So the pictures were always. And then as soon as I got through with the picture, I shoved over to the next board, and Al, whatever Al's name was, he did the lettering. What lettering that guy could do? Just freehand. So I had a table about 8 or 10 feet, about that wide, on the shelf. And on the shelf were these quart bottles of all kinds of tempera. You know, we call it acrylics now. Big bunch of brushes.
And you would do the painting, and he would do the lettering.
Yeah.
An assembly line.
So Joe, who owned the place, he'd say, "All right, Charlie, here's the list." So I look at this damn list of 20 that it was on. Maybe sometimes there were 22, sometimes there were 19 or something.
Well, there's things you had to do out of your head.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I had a box of charcoal, and I'd make a few things, whatever the figure was to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a lot of black ink, and all kinds of color. So these things would evolve, you know. Sometimes it would only be one figure, sometimes it'd be three figures, or maybe a tiger or a leopard or something.
Mm-hmm. And where were you living at that time?
I was living in Philadelphia.
You were still in Philadelphia.
You know, I had a terrific studio. It was 50 by 70 feet.
Wow.
Seating was about as high as this.
Mm-hmm.
And great north windows. It was quite a place.
Where was that?
Third and Walnuts. Which is now, blown the insurance company North America. And I had the whole top floor. And a big balcony with a railing and went out on Walnut Street.
It was an idea.
So I was there for.
And you were married at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Margie's studio was on Washington Square. So I would walk over there about 5 o'clock, and then we'd go for dinner. We had one son who went to Episcopal Academy. So he would come in from the academy by the bus and meet us at the restaurant. So it was quite an interesting sort of a thing. They met a lot of people, and I used to go to New York about twice a month.
Did you know Norman Rockwell?
Yeah, for years.
Mm-hmm.
first met Rockwell about 1917. At Westport. Provincetown, that's where we were. Provincetown.
Yeah.
There was a fellow in the life class at the academy who worked with Rockwell. Rockwell just there for the, I don't know what, the summer, but I had met him, I had been in Illinois before.
He was very young then too, 1970,
yeah.
Sure.
And I think he had, at that time had sold one or two covers. My recollection now is slight, very thin. So I have a lot of letters from him.
Do you really?
Books and photographs.
Oh, how wonderful.
Did you go to New York? Going around to all the publishers, the magazines, and the book publishers. And that used to be a terrible boy. I hated that. Going over on the train, and you had maybe three, four, five, at least canvases all wrapped up with a rope around them. And you had to go in to see the art editor.
There was no such thing as agents, or you just did this yourself?
Well, later I did have an agent over there that did all the...
But did you go to New York with work just to show directors?
Yeah.
To get work?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And then they'd consider it as... Then they'd give you an assignment if they like your work.
Well, you usually had to go three or four times to see one because they... magazine particularly, they had to have a lot of confidence in you to give you a job because they had a schedule to meet. And, well, just like an agency, they said, we want this by 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, eh? And they've talked to you about on Monday about it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to know that you could draw and paint and do the subject and bring it in, and it was all right. So it was, but in New York.
What were some of the things that you did besides post?
Oh, I worked for almost all of the book publishers. I did work for Collier's, for Canadian magazines, a lot of small magazines, weeklies and things like that. I had two magazines in New York, one in London, one in Stockholm. They were usually the second right thing is something that could publish in the United States. So you could sell the second rights to them because then you doubled up the money on it. Whatever you did. So it, but the starting out was very, very different. You didn't have the experience, you didn't know how to approach these fellows, the art directors, and you walk in place with your work, and here's a bench with four or five fellows sitting on there, all with a package. And then they'd go in, and finally you'd get a chance to go in. And they were all pretty good, except once in a while you can see them. I don't want to see that guy again. If I do, I'd shoot him.
Well, there was lots of competition then in illustrating in those days, just as there probably is today.
Companion. I went there about six times, I guess, and finally quit. Because it was a woman's magazine. I always had a little difficulty making pretty girls. I could do the Indians and the cowboys and all that. The beautiful girl sort of eluded me at times.
Mm-hmm.
And then back in those 30s and 40s, that was the thing, you know. You had a good-looking fellow, a good-looking girl, all the romance of the thing. So it was later that the West sort of pushed a lot of those fellows off, and you got work. And I got a lot of work because what I did was authentic. I know what kind of a saddle to use in Dakota, different from New Mexico, and guns. Put the right gun in the right period. So I have very, very few written in criticism from readers. It hardly does know whether, did he ever read the story?
Yeah, I'm sure that would be a grave mistake, putting the wrong saddle on it.
And I used to look at a lot of these things, and I think, well, that's not right.
Having the harness hooked up the wrong way. Well, then your career started to take off for you. Then you started to really pick up.
I was always I was a hard worker. And I was interested in what I was doing, and I always felt that, well, if he does it, I can do it. So it was full of heartaches, headaches, fun and amusement. I wouldn't trade it for anything else.
I'm sure not.
And as you went along, the thing that you were impressed with, the fact that you were an individual working for yourself and they couldn't fire you. They could say,
it's a wonderful feeling, isn't it?
Oh, so you could tell them to go to hell if you wanted to. But they couldn't fire you. So.
They might not give you any more work, but they still couldn't fire you.
Then there was another thing that always was in the office. You worked for a book company or a magazine or what, and you got very well acquainted with the art dealer. And you got to work for him. All of a sudden you went there and he wasn't there anymore. Never knew that. So then you have to start all over again. But the new man coming in, was from some other publication or something, and he had a bunch of fellows
following.
Yeah, so then you had to fight that whole outfit over.
Yeah, really competitive.
I don't know, but I found out that if you do one thing very well, maybe better than 99% of the other people doing the same thing, you're going to get work. You may not, you know, set the world on fire, but you're going to get...
I think it's that way with any field, really. Specialize in one thing.
It came in the later years, everybody became a specialist. People doing sports, pretty girl fellows, the animal fellows did animals. So it...
It was like medicine, like a field of medicine, specializing.
Yeah, the old country doctor is no more.
That's right.
Charles, did you ever run into Mario Cooper, who was a black and white charcoal illustrator?
Yeah.
Of course, he later became a watercolor painter.
Yeah.
And he's now the president of the American Watercolor Society.
Yeah, but
since 1959.
He was... he did back in the 60s.
Before they had color, everything was black and white. Did you have to work in black and white too?
Well, there's one of them up there is black and white.
Or else work with sepia and browns.
Well, I got acquainted with the engraver. I used to be with the Beck Engraving Company, did a lot of work for him. And I got so that if we produced in black and white, I could do it in color. It would come out just as if it was done in black and white. So every once in a while I'd come in with a thing and say, Oh my God, Hardy, we wanted it in color. I said, that's all right, you're gonna do it in black and white. So, and I still have a glass that I could work looking through. I know just how bright to make the red so it comes out just the black that I want. Mm-hmm. And keeping away from the blues, which of course come out very much lighter than the one. But what I did a lot of were Russian ink things, Indian ink and brushes, and charcoal once in a while, pen and ink, which I never liked. I always had to fight pen and ink. But I did a lot of pen and ink illustrations.
You did. But you really enjoy it.
There was a whole school of great pen and ink people in the 20s. '30s, like Henry Pitts.
I knew Henry Pitts for years.
Lyle Justice.
And I knew Justice for years.
You studied under Henry Pitts, didn't you?
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's, I never was happy with pen and ink either. I just don't have the feel for it. But I can handle wash much better because if you use a brush.
And some people, I don't know why, but I saved a lot of ink, and it always reproduced pretty well, but I just was more happy with the paint and the brush. But way back when you're getting going, you'd say, well, we want three pictures. Now these would be done in ink. Or what are you going to do? Well, black and white watercolor. Everything just sort of evolved. You had to keep going and going and going.
Why, when did you move to Bucks County, Mr. Hawkins?
Well, of course, in the West, I always had this feeling of open space or something. So we used to drive up from Philadelphia up into Bucks County and looked all around, and I think particularly because I think my favorite instructor was Daniel Garber. He lived in Lumberville. In fact, when I was going to the academy, he invited three of us up to spend a weekend with him at his place in Lumberville.
Uh-huh.
So then I thought of getting out of the city and coming up this way, so it was. So eventually I did that. Moved up here then.
Do you recall what year that was?
1940.
In 1940.
Yeah. And Marjorie, she kept her studio in Philadelphia and went in every day on the train. I'd take her over to Alaska, where the depot was.
Yes.
And I'd pick her up after 5 o'clock on the out of the train. She did that for 2 or 3 years until it got just too much. So then she just gave up the whole thing.
You had your studio here at the time, and then she continued to go into Philadelphia. Let's see.
She was very exceptional work. Got a lot of work from the advertising agency. Style and she could refigure it.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt it was too bad that she really gave it up.
You were good friends with the Sodders too, weren't you, Charles?
Yeah, when we moved here and the Sodders found out that whoever lived in this house was an artist. That group in Oklahoma City, which was financed by, I guess, the oil interests in the Southwest, and then a big deal. It started with a number of the fellows who were illustrators in the East. illustration died. Out west.
Article on Bill Nye in the Gazette. saw, I think, the whole thing. So I'm right to Shaw and fill him in on a couple of very different stories about Bill Nye.
He'd be very interested, I'm sure.
Yeah. One summer when I came from the West, I was north of Independence Square. I heard someone say, "Hey, Charlie, here's Bill Nye." He said, "I've been sitting on this bench for over a month waiting for you to come back." He said, "I haven't any place to work or stay, and I thought maybe I could have a corner of your studio." So I said, "Well, sure," because I had known him at the Academy for a long time. So he was going to be an illustrator. So he could draw pretty well, and he made some samples. I let him use a drawing table. He did get a job from NWA Advertising Agency, which had to do with a reporter and a mother and a daughter on a Pennsylvania railroad station going away or something. So he did the drawing, and it was perfect good, and it had to be done in pen and ink. And he said, "I'm going out to lunch. You want to go, Bill?" He said, "I have a few more little things to do with this, and I'm going to deliver." I said, "Okay." So I went, I had lunch and came back, and Bill wasn't there. So Bill wasn't even drawing, so I went doing my work. So I had about 2 or 3 o'clock, I thought, "Well, I wonder where he is." So I went over to the drawing table to see. And there was his drawing. He'd upset a bottle of Indy ink and it'd run down all over the drawing.
And he just walked out.
He walked out and I never saw him again until this new book.
That's horrible. I know the feeling. That's cute.
So I thought, "I'll write this to Shaw." You'll be the same, but now there's always an easy way to do this. You don't have to draw the hands, you put them in his pocket behind his back. And then he was not doing what he did in later years.
Mm-hmm. Well, how well did you know Edward Redfield?
Oh, I didn't know Redfield at all, except just going to see him.
I knew you had interviewed him at one time.
Colonel Richardson and Lee Ross. So just a couple of times a year we would just go up there. And Colonel Richardson took a tape recorder. So, and I always admired Redfield as a painter, I think, because he was very direct. Close to doing something, a lot of paint. But I didn't want it at all.
Well, I certainly thank you very much. This has been wonderful for you to give us this time.
Didn't have time to go to the library.